And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. I'm super excited, as always.
Yes, it's a real treat today. We're joined by the fantastic cinematographer Paul Cameron. Paul has been responsible for shooting some of our absolute favorite modern action films, from his supercharged collaborations with the late Tony Scott, including Man on Fire, Deja Vu, and the BMW Films entry Beat the Devil, to his groundbreaking work on Michael Mann's crime thriller Collateral. Other efforts include the slick and gritty actioners Gone in 60 Seconds from director Dominic Senna and producer Jerry Bruckheimer, the cyber terrorism thriller Swordfish with John Travolta and Hugh Jackman, the small gem In the Land of Women with Meg Ryan. I highly urge people to check that one out. It's really good. And he also shot Dead Man Down recently with Colin Farrell and Noomi Rapace. He's got some huge projects coming up next year and beyond. The HBO series Westworld from Jonathan Nolan, which is hitting TV screens, HBO, in 2016. And recently he just wrapped principal photography on the latest Pirates of the Caribbean installment. And as most listeners of this podcast will know, I'm certainly one of the world's biggest Tony Scott fans, so this really is a true honor to get a chance to speak with one of his key artistic collaborators. I know Frank is super excited too, so welcome to the show, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Yeah, good to be here.
Awesome. I just want to say thank you very much again. Nick and I have been looking forward to this for all weekend. I've been prepping, and this evening I just rewatched Deja Vu, which is one of my favorite Tony Scott films, and I think that that film is just so visually stunning. It's insane.
Oh, great. Thanks, man.
And there's so many things. I don't even know where to begin to ask about that. I guess I'm most curious about how did you conceive the visual look of that film?
Well, Deja Vu is a bit complicated. We were, I was down in New Orleans with Tony Scott just before Katrina hit, and we were tech scouting and getting ready to go. We were probably about 5-6 weeks out, so we were very close to shooting, and then Katrina hit, obviously. So we were evacuated 2 days before, and, we came back as quickly as we could, and Tony was a big proponent in trying to get the movie back to New Orleans to help New Orleans and try to do what he could do to bring the film business back there and keep the movie there. In terms of the look of the movie, it's the challenge for me was really, I scattered a movie that took a lot of scenes took place out on the streets at night, and then after the unfortunate storm Katrina, all the lights were wiped out. So suddenly we had this night landscape that was in darkness. So I engaged in some tests right away. I just kind of tried to talk Tony into being open to the idea of using the Genesis from Panavision, the new digital camera there. I mean, I'd had the experience with Collateral, but we could talk about it further, but I see all these cameras, and I still do, as kind of like film stocks. Panavision came out with this Genesis camera, and I was actually able to really push this camera and open the shutter and dig in. So we developed a kind of a night look for this film with my gaffer at the time, Phil Walker, and we basically threw a lot of industrial lights that we manufactured ourselves that are, some are quite powerful even to this day, sodium and mercury halide. So we had to kind of build our own night look to New Orleans at that time. But, I'll just finish it up by saying the beginning, Tony was very against shooting digital. And I did a whole bunch of tests with Stefan Sonnenfeld over at Company 3. And I emulated, daytime skip bleach looks and night looks. And, I basically mixed this whole thing up and screened some stuff to him to show Tony to see if he could figure out what was digital and what wasn't. And I think it confused him enough that he basically just said, I don't know what that is, but it looks great, and do it. So that's where the genesis kind of came in. And then the last thing I'll say about Deja Vu was really the interesting thing was Tony really welcomed the technology, as did Michael Mann. And Tony really welcomed this idea, because at the end of our shooting schedule, we were going to do all the lab scenes where Denzel is actually, they're looking at this, into this time machine of sorts, right? So I said, well, why the hell don't we just shoot it live? We'll take all the footage, we'll cut the footage, we'll play back, live digital projection, we'll shoot it live, I'll do the whole set of the lab, practical lighting, and we'll shoot it with the Genesis at 5000 ASA, and we'll do the least amount of practical lighting as we can. And Tony loved the idea, and not only did we do that, but I made glass that basically emulated ground glasses, so that I could project onto it and shoot back onto Denzel like we're shooting through the projection. And that added this whole other element of an emotional quality to that scene, those scenes in the lab. And I guess that's, the amazing thing about Tony was that he really welcomed all of that. He was probably the most, collaborative and most supportive director for cinematographers I've ever experienced that way. So.
Yeah, his films certainly were a cinematographer's, at least what I can imagine to be, a cinematographer's dream come true. He was always a filmmaker interested in what aesthetically was possible, within the framework of each narrative, of course. But he was always at the forefront of something new and interesting with style. And one of the things I always loved so much about Deja Vu is that it's one of the more like impressionistic action films that I can think of. Coming off of Domino, which I think was really like the apex of his style. I think that it was just like the culmination of everything maybe he was going after as an artist. He brought some of that really experimental, wild style to Deja Vu, which you normally don't get a chance to see in a big budget, mass consumption blockbuster. Was it ever discussed that this was going to maybe lean towards more like of an avant-garde style than your traditional Jerry Bruckheimer, popcorn movie?
I think that was just the nature of working with Tony. I mean, avant-garde is a good way to put it. I mean, we it's advanced garde. It's people that are, kind of just on the top of the curve with art and technology, basically. And that's where he kind of always existed. So he was the first one to support something fresh that served the story. I mean, the idea of using a digital camera went against every bone in his body. And then when, I could prove the results on the screen, and then when we could actually utilize it and shoot multiple cameras with live projection. And I mean, he couldn't have been happier, So I think like any great artist, if they're in a collaborative medium and they see people bringing in this kind of, new ideas and new possibilities, he was the first to welcome them,
Frank.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say, Frank, you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just, not to bounce around too terribly much, Okay, cool. I look at the work with Tony Scott's, with Deja Vu, and then what you did with Collateral, and I might be mistaken here, but I almost look at you and your collaboration with them as the digital breakthrough onto the film medium and what you could actually do. Mm-hmm. With digital and make it a strength and do something completely different that you can't do with film. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I'll tell you just to address that directly is, the experience on Collateral and designing the look for Collateral, you know, Michael had shot a couple scenes with Manuel Lubezki and Ali on the Sony 900, and Michael was using the Sony 900 on a TV show he was executive producing to great success. And you know, when I looked at that footage, it was very rough. And in Ali, it's just a couple of scenes. There's one on a bridge and one on a rooftop that are very, very quick. So in the context of those movies, you don't really see it. So when we talked about it on Collateral, it was really, you know, the possibility of doing a whole film digitally, it was really strictly an artistic choice. You know, it was pre-manufacturer, getting led down the path technologically. So, I started shooting tests for Collateral, and I found this kind of, you know, acidic, kind of acrid, metallic, kind of emotional quality to these images. And, you know, when you sit in we were fortunate enough to sit in Michael's screening room and look at, you know, the equivalent of 2K projection of this material up there. And it was just undeniable. It was, you know, it was like, that's what LA feels like at night, you know? So to me, you know, what I did is basically said, well, let me just see if I can get that look on film. Now that we have the look, let me see if I can get it on film. It'll be much easier to shoot it on film. Let me try to emulate it. Long story short, couldn't get there. Digital was digital. That Sony 900 was the right camera to shoot Collateral on now, you know. And that's hence the beginning of the way I kind of look at the digital technology in terms of, okay, I found a film stock. It just happens to be an electronic digital capture system that's a bit different. So the transition into Deja Vu was a different necessity. It was because we needed to photograph the nights at least 5, sometimes 8,000 ISO with no shutter, you know, 358 degree shutter, just so I can get the stop in there. I feel like, you know, certainly Collateral was the step forward. I mean, Star Wars and a couple films were beginning to shoot digitally as we were finishing. But, you know, I have to say, I mean, I was never in a situation before where I had to pick, you know, film or digital. And I didn't have to here. You know, I could have recommended film and Michael would have made his decision either way, you know. But I think the difference back then is I was able to make a choice based on an artistic decision as opposed to now where it doesn't seem to be that way for a lot of people, you know, they have to shoot digitally. So,
yeah, it definitely seems like with a few holdouts, almost everybody is now shooting digitally. And, you know, one can make the argument that there's more time progresses, digital cameras get better and better, and they begin to approximate that special look and feel of film, which Frank and I have discussed on numerous podcasts. The illusion of the cinema, of sitting down in the theater and watching something that you know is a movie, and there's something sort of between you and the cinema world. And with digital, you sort of lose that quality in a certain way, and not necessarily the thing that's bad, it's just different. And I think that I think one of the most exciting things for me with Collateral, and this is a movie I saw 5 times in the theater, I just want to tell you, this is when I was living in Los Angeles and I was doing nothing but going to the movies left and right. If I wasn't working, I was in a theater. And if I remotely liked a movie, I saw it twice. If I really enjoyed it, I saw it multiple times. And with Collateral, my mind was completely blown. And I can remember seeing it in the dome at the Arclight on opening night. And one of the things that I love so much about the way that you use digital in Collateral was that you were able to see so far off into the distance at nighttime in Los Angeles. There was sort of this open expanse of the urban environment. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall that atmospheric feeling being in too many thrillers up until that point. And I think that's one of the coolest things about digital is that it sort of allows you to peer further into the distance of things.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree specifically with the nightscapes, you know, and it's you know, what we found, you know, it's funny, when we scouted Collateral, Michael Mann had one of the new Canon digital cameras, and I don't remember whether it was the 10D at the time or something. It was the first, it was basically the first generation of the digital cameras and SLRs, and I had a Casio 2-megapixel credit card camera. And this thing just rocked. I mean, it took the most unbelievable pictures at night, you know, without any, you know, just it went to some unknown, ISO or ASA, and it was taking these, you know, amazing pictures. And Michael was taking great pictures on his camera. And I, you know, every day I would, after the scout, we'd scout all night, by the way, and then, you know, we'd finish at about 4 in the morning, and then we'd have to be back at work at 8, you know, and start the next day. Of which I would print all my pictures from the night before and put them on his desk. And these, you know, these pictures didn't lie. They're, it's kind of what your eye, you know, the experience of what it's like to stand there, you know, when you're looking at the, you know, the glow of the clouds against the, you know, the 75-foot cypress tree or, you know, 100-foot palm tree, you know, where you see the silhouette of the tree or the downtown with, you know, glowing at night, you know. These are images that have only been rendered with, you know, timed exposures and stills in the past. And now suddenly, you know, on the advent of the new digital technology, we could see this stuff, you know. And you're right, it's adding a whole new level to the night landscape. And, you know, it's pretty amazing. And it's, you know, I was out shooting the other night downtown, and you know, we're just digging in, you know, on higher ASAs and open shutters and just getting amazing clean results again, you know, and it is a different world, you know, that way.
I do want to jump back to Deja Vu. Sure. Real quick. I wanted to ask you about that dual time chase car scene.
Mm.
And how you created that, because it's so aesthetically amazing.
Mm.
In that film that I'm always enthralled by it every time I see it.
Yeah, I mean, I had a little experience shooting car chases, like on Gone in 60 Seconds and BMW film I did with Tony Scott and some other stuff I had done, but you know, I think when I read this, like, you know, this car chase, it's basically, you know, a guy chasing somebody, you know, 4 days earlier, or whatever the time difference was, you know, it was like, Jesus, how are we going to pull that off, you know? And, you know, it's like anything else, once you start to break it down, you know, and you see the actual pieces you need, it's this, you know, parallel action of him chasing with, you know, basically seeing, you know, into another time dimension where he's chasing, you know, Jim Caviezel. It was pretty challenging. And for some reason, it all kind of made sense. So I don't know.
And you've never seen it. You've never seen that before. Like, how many action movies have there been? How many car chases have there been? I can't think of another movie where you're seeing a car chase existing on two time wavelengths simultaneously. And I just, like Frank said, it's a mind blowing sequence. Yeah. And it's one of those things that you haven't seen before.
No, it's great because he's chasing somebody, but you know, he's in a different timescape, and there's other obstacles in front of him that
right.
He's negotiating, and cars, you know, the usual car chase cars flipping and turning
and how do you go about shooting that kind of stuff on the bridge where there's seemingly all of this mayhem, and obviously, you know, it's a movie and it's controlled, but I mean, that stuff is okay. Shot in small pieces. It's like, how did you do car flips on that bridge? And like,
it's like everything, you know, normally, you know, and I've done this a lot with Tony or other directors, and I'm, you know, firmly believe, you know, first of all, safety, but second of all, you want to do as much real, you know, photography as you can. And what I love, you know, one of the things I love most about working with Tony was he wanted to shoot action as complete as possible without interrupting it. So therefore, you know, if you look at some of these sequences, like if the car's approaching, you know, on the bottom of the bridge, there might be two or three cameras that are shooting that and a helicopter shooting that. Then as it goes to the center of the bridge, there's another two or three cameras shooting a car pass there, maybe car to car, and the helicopter jumps in as well there with a couple other cameras, and then you do the jump. I mean, a lot of directors would break it down, like just do the jump, you know, the stunt, put it five cameras on it. But we never did that. We had five cameras at the beginning of the bridge, five in the middle, and another 10, you know, for the jump. And then, I don't know, a couple more down the road, you know. So, I mean, there was, he always wanted to keep going. Like, if he could have set up, you know, a few hundred cameras and started the movie and shot it beginning to end without cutting, he would have, you know. He just, he had this amazing way of orchestrating, you know, and trusting, you know, multiple cameras and, you know, covering it in a dynamic way and carrying the action as long as possible to make it authentic as possible. You know, and these were, you know, people have shot great action throughout history, but I will say shooting action with Tony, I don't think I ever learned as much from one person about, you know, how to cover these events and how to elongate the events to get the best possible results, you know.
I think you kind of did a perfect segue, and I think it would probably be just the right time to talk about Man on Fire because, mm-hmm. you know, that film is, I mean, it's, so many people love it. It's considered one of Tony Scott's best films. It's a film that's aged really well. And it really is just a dynamic sort of example of his style. What was it like putting that film together in the way that it was put together in terms of how, I've talked about this online in some pieces I've written, and Frank and I have talked about it as well. It sort of like feels like a cubist movie in a way. Like there's all these small pictures that are being used to create this big final tableau. And I've always seen it as this great piece of work that's, it's almost kaleidoscopic in a way. Where did the Man on Fire aesthetic, which has now been borrowed from heavily throughout, you know, since it's been released. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think it's, you know, listen, the, you know, Men on Fire, the style of Man on Fire kind of manifested itself out of the experience of shooting it for the most part. We, you know, Tony and I had done this film for BMW Films with James Brown and Gary Oldman.
Beat the Devil, yeah, it's fantastic. Devil.
Maybe 2 months before we started pre-production on Man on Fire, and we had done a series of Buick commercials just before that, and we were talking about the film a lot. I had just started working with him. He offered me Man on Fire pretty quickly, and I said I would do it, and we, you know, basically used the commercials in the BMW film to kind of test a few things, and one of those was a hand crank camera, which he had used, and I had used, you know, in the past as well for various reasons. And we said, okay, well, let's give this a shot. And, you know, what transpired basically is, you know, in the testing of Man on Fire was fairly radical because we even considered shooting. We did tests. Our first tests were Super 16, with some hand crank 35 reversal that was a reversal film that I cross processed. So, but, you know, effectively you're developing it as a negative instead of a positive, and that gives you that kind of color fringing and insane color. I mean, just a quick anecdote. I remember the first test I brought back from Mexico City. We landed here in Los Angeles and we were on our way to Fox Studio to show the test to the head of the studio. And producers. Unfortunately, on the way there, something came up for Tony, so he had to leave, and he said, okay, just go show him the test. Everything's cool. See you back at the airport in 2 hours or whatever. So in the screening room, I showed the test, and there was dead silence.
Dead silence.
come up, and the studio executives were like, what are we looking at here? And I'm like, well, these are the tests Tony and I are doing. And they were like, it's all grainy. The color's weird. And the tests were probably even more radical than the movie. But, you know, when I was looking at the tests, and when Tony and I screened the tests before we came up to Los Angeles, is there was something about it, again, that was very tactile and very emotional about those images. And we said, screw it. We're going to shoot, we're going to shoot some 16. We're going to shoot some 35. We're going to shoot cross-process reversal, hand crank. We're going to do what we feel like doing for the sake of the story. And, the idea for me of the hand crank camera and that kind of style that I was trying to bring to the movie was basically coming out of, Denzel's character and the whole just emotional reality of, alcoholic, depressed guy who's on his, he's one bullet away from killing himself, and he's struggling with, suicide, and he meets a young, young girl that he drives for that, and they share this incredible love relationship, right? So, to me, I wanted this kind of everything's okay, and then when he goes into this kind of suicidal, drunken state, I wanted, to use the hand crank cameras more. Well, that was great until we started shooting, and once you start shooting, hand crank camera with a reversal film, you're getting these dailies back. I mean, I was doing quadruple exposures, and, we basically hand crank forward, you cap it, you go back, you go forward, you go back, you go forward, you go back, you go forward. So some of these shots have like four exposures in them, and people were suddenly showing up like, I've never seen that many people in dailies before. And they were looking at this film going like, Jesus, this is just, great. And then Tony, would show up the next night and we're going to go do a shootout, and Tony's like, let's shoot it hand crank. And I'd be like, no, it's for the character, Tony. It's for the character. He's like, I don't care about you. Let's do it. I want to do it now. It feels right. And I'm like, okay, great. I had planned the shoot, whatever at the time, 52-84 expression. I was going to push it a stop and shoot like, on zooms, which he always wanted to shoot on. So I knew I was going to be at the bottom of the exposure. Now suddenly I'm on 50 ASA film, an hour before principal photography, can we do it? And I'm like, Jesus, I don't know if I could pull it off, So, of course we did, and we pulled it off, and we found ways to do it. And, I loosened my strings when he responded like he wanted to do it. It's his movie, and suddenly the style kind of was exciting him, And, would A Man on Fire be the same movie without all that? I think on some level it would. It's still just a beautiful love story. But, this kind of collision of creative energy with Tony and myself and, hand crank cameras and reversal film and multiple exposures. There was just something about that collision that really worked for that,
So regardless to say, Tony Scott kept you on your toes. There was always something new around the corner with him.
There's always something new all the time, But, one of the amazing things working with somebody like him is, you can scout something to death, which I did with him all the time. And you have a plan, you have a plan, you have a plan. And then you go there and the light's different that day. And the vibe is different. And we didn't even have to say anything to each other. We would just turn the opposite direction and tell them to clear all the vehicles. That's the direction we're shooting, I mean, there's a good example of the power of a guy like that. And a director is in Man on Fire when Denzel dies, right? Basically in the back of the vehicle, right? With a volcano in the background. Yep. That whole scene, we shot for a day and a half, we shot that sequence. And there was just something not right. The light wasn't great. The stage, there was just something about it that was very frustrating, and it wasn't really coming together. And on the second day, and this is outside of Puebla, Mexico, where that overpass is, at, you know, the middle of the second day, they called lunch, and Denzel was in the car, and I was sitting there with Tony, and there was a volcano right there, and it was Tony's birthday, and we were sitting there smoking a cigar, and we looked over, and I'm not kidding, the volcano blew. It shot ash out, and as it shot ash out, clouds parted, light started streaming through. And I looked at Tony. I knew immediately. I was like, okay, I'll find so-and-so. I'll get the camera car driver, blah, blah. We got a few people. We got out on the road. You know, I got Tony to crank the camera. I mean, I cranked the camera. I had Tony operating sometimes. You know, we traded off a lot because we did it a lot together because we were just in a groove. And we shot all the stuff with Denzel in the back of the car with three people. By the time we got back to the location, the sun was streaming. And I didn't even have to ask him. I knew. I could see on his face. We had to reshoot a day and a half of footage and finish everything else in 4 hours. So, you know, it's like, how do you do it? Well, I can't tell you except that we did it, you know, and we shot, I don't know, five camera setups in a few hours. And we reshot everything we shot. And we shot all the material that was owed, and it was 10 times better, and it was his birthday, and the volcano blew. And that's just like, you can't, you know, like, I can't even explain. It's like, this doesn't happen with a lot of people in life, you know what I mean? So that's just a little anecdote on that. So,
wow. Yeah. Yeah, like as we've said multiple times throughout the, you know, our chat here, I mean, Frank and I were such big fans of Tony's work, and in particular your collaborations with him. I would love to know, mm-hmm. And I'm sure Frank would be curious to know too. You got your start after working in music videos, and I know that, and some commercials and stuff. How did you get mm-hmm. the gig with Bruckheimer and Dominic Senna on Gone in 60 Seconds? That because you did. That and then Swordfish, which has that rather famous tilt-a-whirl crazy shot in the opening, which I've always wanted to know a little bit more about. How did those early efforts come about?
Well, you know, I'd done a couple smaller movies in New York, and you know, I was raised in New York, went to college in New York, and lived in New York City for many years, and so, you know, I found my way into the union, and I found ways to shoot rock and roll before MTV, and you know, just kind of did it. And, you know, suddenly I kind of found myself a little bit more in the commercial world out west. You know, after being in New York for a while, I came out west. And, you know, fortunately, I met up with this great director cameraman, Dominic Senna. I mean, he was really an insanely good DP that was directing and shooting. And he had done that movie, California.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I just called him up out of the blue, and I said, I just walked out of a theater and I saw your movie and I loved it. I loved the look of it. And yeah, I said, great. You know, I didn't know him from a hole in the wall. And then, you know, like about a month later, he invited me to go to Norway to shoot these American Express commercials for the 96 Olympics in Norway. And that was kind of the beginning of our working together in commercials. And, you know, quite honestly, I didn't really expect it. I was certainly looking for movies out here at the time, and I was on stage. This was, you know, I think cell phones were still bricks, but I was on a stage, and, you know, somebody yelled over, hey, so, you know, this guy Dominic wants to talk to you, and I picked up the phone. He said, can you come to Bruckheimer tomorrow? And I said, sure. And he goes, well, you know, prepare yourself a little. I want you to shoot this, you know, I think it was $100 million, just shy of it. And I said, fantastic, let's do it. You know, so, you know, the next couple of days I went to meet Jerry and Mike Stenson and Chad Oman, who were the executives at the time, and Chad's still there. And, you know, it was basically they grilled me, like, you know, okay, are you ready? You know, that's great. You've done these commercials and videos and little movies. Are you ready, you know, to do a, you know, big action movie? And I said, sure. Sure. Let's do it. And that was that. You know, I think I was so eager that remember the first night of principal photography on Gone in 60 Seconds was down at San Pedro, and it's basically the scene of the guys coming back to the warehouse and being chased by all the police and helicopters and through San Pedro, and then they pull into the warehouse and go running and off.
Classic Bruckheimer scene right there. Yeah, let me tell you. Yeah.
And then and I remember I had I had two camera cars, one helicopter. I had a couple night lights, Musco type lights here and there, and all the usual crap all over San Pedro. And I think I had a camera crew about, six or seven cameras at the time, which was fairly radical. And it was an amazing night. And we shot an interior scene with dialogue, all this action. Then we went inside after and shot the scene. And then, that was my first day. And I remember I was staying in a hotel in San Pedro and the sun was coming up, and I walked into my room. I sat down on the bed and I was just like, okay, kid, you better slow down because you have a long movie ahead of you, And then, I saw the producer, Barry Wallman, the next day, and he's like, how you doing? And I'm like, I'm doing okay. He goes, okay, so now you're going to pay, we're going to pace this movie a little? And I was like, yeah, man, we're going to pace this movie a little. So it was good, though. It was great. So, working with Dom was a great experience, and, Gone in 60 Seconds was, it was a fun stylized movie, and that carried over to Swordfish with Dominic. So I really am, so thankful to Dom and first Jerry Bruckheimer and then Joel Silver for Deja Vu.
Action producers get you started with your big budget, movie career. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, it was good. And I work very hard and I love what I do. So, and the timing was just great for me. So, it really gave me a chance to do something good,
I wanted to ask you about upcoming Westworld for HBO.
Sure.
I'm very much looking forward to that. I love the original film. I even dig the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
But from the trailer that was released, I think it looks absolutely amazing. And you shot the pilot of that?
Yes.
Okay. And is that the only one you shot? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I just shot episodes, effectively the first episode of what I believe is a 12-part series, or at least a 10-part series. They're still in production right now. And that's for Jonathan, or better known as Jonah Nolan, the brother of Chris Nolan, and who was an amazing writer, amazing human being. And, I can't really tell you much about Westworld.
Right.
Technically,
all good.
We shot, it wasn't even a question when I met with Jonah. He's like, you're good with film, right? And I'm like, I still have some in my garage. Of course, you need some, And he's like, well, no, I mean, like shooting this whole thing. And I was like, you kidding me? Of course, fantastic, And everything that Jonah put on the table was just undeniably good news to my ears. And I didn't hesitate, saying yes to it, because I've done a couple TV pilots over the years, but I haven't done any in many years. And, of course I was thinking about, okay, well, it's such a short number of days, but there was a big budget and we shot 20 days or something like that. So it was big, there's a big cast in it, as there's a lot of characters. There's, a lot to deal with in the first episode. And, I have to say, working with Jonah Nolan was just heroic. He's just, he's going to be a major, he already is, but he's just going to be
right.
A major force to contend with in the film business. He's going to be one of the most amazing directors, I think, ever. He already is. So,
Yeah. I can't wait for that. As soon as they announced that Ed Harris was cast as the Man in Black, I was
he's
sold. 100% sold.
Insane. Yeah, it looks really, really cool. I don't know what you see these trailers, and I don't know what's from the pilot and what's not, but what appears to be like one of the robots getting created in some sort of white viscous goo, or that image has not left my head. I can't wait to see more of that. And
it's cool. I think the teaser that they released is basically, you know, all the stuff from the pilot.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I know Brendan Galvin and Robert McLaughlin are the two DPs, and they're you know, trying to keep true to the look, but I look forward to seeing what they've added to the look of the show. I mean, it's this show is about the content 100%. You know, there's nothing more important than that in the show, and it should be pretty damn cool.
And you've also just, if I'm not mistaken, you just finished shooting the new Pirates of the Caribbean, getting back to work with Jerry Bruckheimer again. I'm sure you can't tell us anything about the plot or anything like that. But what can you say about the experience of shooting, you know, one of the biggest franchise, you know, movies out there?
Well, listen, Gore Verbinski and Derek, you know, Darius Wolski are responsible for, you know, the first three Pirates, which are, you know, absolutely fun and beautiful to watch. And Rob Marshall did the last one, and Darius shot the last one as well. So stepping in, you know, it was fun to be called Joachim Rønning and Espen Sandberg, the directors, to young Norwegian guys, brought some new energy to the franchise, and I think everybody will be happy with it. And you know, we have the addition of Javier Bardem, and you know what was great, you know, more than anything, I think about shooting Pirates is we got to shoot it down in Australia, and we were on the Gold Coast, just south of Brisbane, and you know, at the beginning, I was a little reticent about going down there, you know, since we weren't in Sydney or Melbourne, and we were kind of, you know, in the middle of the Gold Coast. And but fortunately, I was able to bring a handful of crew, and I got the best crew anyone could ever hope for. And the Australians were amazing. Toby Copping was the most amazing grip. And I had two gaffers. I had the illustrious Rafael Sanchez from the United States, and Sean Conway from Australia, and these, you know, so to be blessed with two of the best gaffers in the world, it was good. And, you know, I think I brought some new stuff to it. I mean, the directors have a very, very distinct style that we tried to stay true to, and I think we all tried to bring what we could to it. And, you know, I did things like I had a new drone built for the Alexa M, because you can't fly any drone that heavy anywhere, you know, in the United States or North America or a lot of countries. So, you know, I was able to fast track a drone with this company XM2 out of Melbourne, and these guys are going to be here soon, and we're going to be able to fly the stuff soon. But a lot of the big ship stuff is done on, you know, these two blue screen arenas that I built that are basically the size of two IKEA buildings, they're massive, you know, to accommodate ships 130 feet wide. So they're like 60 feet with air walls that go up 20 feet and gimbals that rock the boats. And, you know, so, you know, technically it was a very insane journey. It's the most, well, let's put it this way. I signed on to the movie 3 years ago, and, same directors, but it was a different producer. We were going down to Puerto Rico, and we were going to shoot all the ships in the water and finish up all of our sets in New Orleans, or, you know, somewhere, depending on the tax credits. You know, for whatever reason, the movie went down for a year. When it came back up, suddenly we're not on the water. You know, the methodology had changed on the movie, and we were, you know, basically challenged with shooting a water movie on blue screen for the most part, which for me was quite interesting. You know, I've never done that. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see that. And goes for Westworld and your future projects that you will have lined up, I'm sure, soon. Thank you so very much for coming on our show.
Okay,
this
great,
was
guys.
An unbelievable chat. Well,
thanks for the opportunity, and look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. You're more than welcome back anytime.
Right. Anytime, Paul. Thanks a lot, man. It really was truly an honor to get a chance to talk to you. And like Frank said, really look forward to seeing Westworld and Pirates and everything else. So thanks again.
All right. Well, let me know when you see Westworld. All right. Okay.
For sure.
All right. Thanks,
guys. Have a good one.
Bye-bye. Cheers.
Bye.
Yeah, take it easy.